It's Wednesday, December 17th, 2014, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are Missouri School of Journalism colleagues Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, MSNBC's new online product, The Shift. The Cosbys speak out, Bill calling on the black press to tell his story fairly, and wife Camille using the embattled Rolling Stone rape story to defend her husband. And Sony says it will sue any media organization that publishes stolen emails obtained through that computer hack. Does it mean we as the media should stop publishing them? There's a lot more that we'll hopefully get to as well, but I want to start with the power of words. Tell me, what is the difference between an enhanced interrogation technique and torture? Word choice has been front and center in the coverage of the CIA report that was released last week. Sunday, former Vice President Dick Cheney went on Meet the Press, and Chuck Todd tried to ask him for his definition of torture and whether our government engaged in it.
Definition is the one that was provided by the Office of Legal Counsel. We went specifically to them because we did not want to cross that line into where we were violating some international agreement that we'd signed up to. They specifically authorized and okayed, for example, exactly what we did. All of the techniques that were authorized by the president were, in effect, blessed by the Justice Department opinion that we could go forward to those without, in fact, committing torture.
Let me go through some of those techniques that were used. Majid Khan was then suspected of, was subjected to involuntary rectal feeding and rectal hydration. It included two bottles of Ensure. Later in the same day, Majid Khan's lunch tray, consisting of hummus, pasta, sauce, nuts, and raisins, was pureed and rectally infused. That doesn't meet the definition of torture?
That does not meet the definition of what was used in the program.
No, I understand that, but does that meet the definition of torture in your mind?
In my mind, I've told you what meets the definition of torture. It's what 19 guys armed with airline tickets and box cutters did to 3,000 Americans on 9/11.
So there we have it, Dick Cheney's definition of torture. And over again through that Meet the Press interview, he kept coming back to the idea that the enhanced interrogation techniques that were outlined in that report weren't torture.
Well, I mean, I don't think anyone is surprised that Dick Cheney and others from the Bush administration would back what they did. I mean, and when you look at it, I mean, yesterday, NBC News basically announced that they did a poll along with the Wall Street Journal that 51% of the people that they polled basically said that they were okay with these enhanced terror techniques or whatever you want to call them. So, I mean, it's just one of those things where I think the public is okay, at least the majority of the public is okay with what was done in their name. Now, how that's going to look years from now, who's to say?
And, you know, I kind of think there's a distinction between what Americans believe as to whether or not this was torture and whether it was okay. My guess is that most Americans say, yeah, it was torture, but a lot of Americans think it was okay during the circumstances. And although I would agree that, you know, Cheney kind of lacks a little bit of credibility and he won't even address the word torture except to say, you know, it's what happened to the 9/11 victims. That's true. But I also think that we also have a lot of revisionist history going on from critics this past week who failed to look back and say, what was going on in this country a year, two, 3 years after 9/11? What was the mood in the country? What did the government think might be happening in terms of future attacks? It might be just as bad or worse. We can't leave the context out when we're looking back now, you know, a dozen years later and saying, was it torture?
No. I mean, I think if you just look back 8 years ago when President Obama came into office, I mean, one of the things that the public was saying was that, okay, we don't want to do this. And I think part of it was, we don't want to do this anymore. We want to sort of move away from this. And I think when people go back and they look at it, they will probably say, at the time, during that time, this is what we feel like we had to do as a country in order to be able to feel safe. And I think that's where part of this is coming from.
So let's talk about this from the perspective of news coverage and bringing it back to that idea of word choice. There were some news organizations, some media organizations that stuck with that term of enhanced interrogation techniques, others that went with torture. NPR went so far as to actually issue an ethics statement suggesting that employees stick with certain terminology. Let's talk about that for a second.
Well, first of all, I mean, I think that the NPR guidelines were very nuanced. And from that standpoint, I really appreciate them. They only use the phrase enhanced interrogation techniques when they were quoting what defenders of the practice were calling it. They never used it themselves. They did say it was okay to use torture in some instances, but they preferred kind of a middle ground, which they've been criticized for, like brutal interrogations. And I think most of us would agree they were brutal interrogations.
I mean, yeah. I mean, if you go and you read that report or you listen to others who talk about the report, I mean, there was some pretty graphic details in there and pretty horrific.
And some of those we heard Chuck Todd lay out for Vice President Cheney right there.
Exactly. And people will say to me, that's torture. And the problem becomes is when you're reporting that as a journalist, you're trying to figure out, okay, should I say what I think or should I say what I'm hearing from others? And I think if journalists would stick to what are others saying, both those who defended the practice and those who are against the practice, and let them tell the story as opposed to us trying to define it.
Okay. Well, 2 weeks ago, the last time the three of us were together, we talked about the cyber attack on Sony Pictures. Well, that story isn't going away. In fact, it's only getting bigger. Since that time, we've seen the publication of private emails sent between studio execs. We've seen details leaked about certain actors' talent or perceived lack thereof. And we've seen jokes that, frankly, aren't very funny. A number of news organizations have published them in their entirety, those emails, and I'm not just talking about tabloid publications. Sony Pictures have sent letters through their attorneys threatening to sue any news organization that publishes the stolen communications. Television and movie writer Aaron Sorkin wrote an op-ed for the New York Times about why he says it's time to stop printing those emails. Yesterday, he went on the Today Show to reinforce that message. Here he is with the Today Show's Savannah Guthrie.
There are certainly times when the press has an obligation to publish things that were stolen. I talk about the Pentagon Papers, but you don't even have to use that as your standard. Loosen the standards a little bit. Is there anything in these emails at all that's in the public interest, that points to wrongdoing at the company, that helps anyone in any way? There isn't. There's just gossip there. You can loosen the standards even more, but ultimately you have to dispense with standards entirely in order to be okay with publishing these emails.
It's hard to defend a decision to print salacious emails that are gossipy about this actor or this actress, but can you really say there's zero public importance? I mean, you do have, for example, an email between the Sony chief executive and a Hollywood producer where they're making racially tinged jokes about the president of the United States.
Yeah, I'm so much less interested in a tasteless joke than I am in a massive invasion of privacy, and that's what's happened here.
So Sorkin says that the hackers stole the emails and all of this other information that's been put out there in order to make a point. Exactly what that point is, we may not be sure of just yet. But he thinks what the press is doing, it's doing just to make a nickel.
You know, I have to say that for once, I agree almost entirely with Aaron Sorkin about this. I mean, should the media never use stolen information for a story? Of course not. I mean, he cited Pentagon Papers. We can think of a lot of other stories like that, including Edward Snowden, where that's the only way, because the government is covering up something, that we're going to be able to talk about a matter of public importance. I don't even think we should say we should never rule out using stolen corporate emails if, as he suggests, it leads to some uncovering of wrongdoing at a major scale on a part of a company. But nothing like that has been shown to be in these emails yet. It's just about page views or a nickel. I think he's right.
I think a lot of this information goes directly to the celebrity gossip complex, industrial complex, however you want to put it. These are things that they're like, this is the holy grail. I mean, we've gotten inside of a major studio and we can get all of this information, and it works to sell what we're trying to sell, either online or TMZ, or you can just go all the way around. The other thing is that the other studios have not tried to back Sony in saying that, hey,
there's
media,
no solidarity
this needs
that's
to stop. There's no
there.
Solidarity in it. And a lot of it goes back to the fact that you've seen this sort of separation. I mean, they're used to band together when things like this happen. And now you've seen this sort of cutthroat separation of these studios where they're all looking out for each other and not for the industry as a whole.
Here's the problem I have with a couple of the excuses. I'm not surprised that a BuzzFeed or some other gossipy kind of, you know, site is going to run these rumors. Okay, I get that. I don't like it, but I get it. But when I hear other more mainstream or traditional media saying either one of two things, well, one, you know, the story, the horse is out of the barn, so I guess I have to cover it because people are talking about it. I don't buy that excuse. And two, this one really cracked me up from the folks at Bloomberg. Mm-hmm. They were saying, well, we think it did a public service because it's alerting the public to just how easy it is for private information on publicly accessible servers to get out there. You think we don't know that?
So that's why we need to know that there's a director who thinks that Angelina Jolie is a brat.
Yeah, we don't. That's right. That logic just completely fails.
And the thing that really concerns me is the fact that, you know, you're publishing records. I mean, their salaries, their home addresses, aliases that actors and actresses are using to stay away from stalkers, health information of employees of Sony. I mean, how is that in any way something that the American public really needs to know? I mean, it does more danger to those individuals than it does to actually informing people.
And frankly, I mean, I think what we're doing is we're basically giving publicity, kind of like we would to somebody who's going to commit suicide or whatever. We're encouraging other copycat activities as if the hackers need any further incentive.
Which is one of the things that has had this issue. I'm kind of surprised that 2 weeks after this cyber attack, it's still a story. But that's part of it, is that gossip. You know, the news yesterday that there are certain movie theater chains that are now choosing not to run the film The Interview, which is what is believed to possibly be the source of this attack in a connection with North Korea. There's real news that's going on here that is getting lost in the salacious printing of emails.
You could even argue that the fact that these theaters are now canceling the premiere of this movie for fear of terrorism or security or whatever, that's on us as much as it's on the hackers. I mean, basically, you could say that we're encouraging a limitation on freedom of expression because we want to make a nickel off of this salacious information.
I mean, and the thing about it is one of the main reasons why these theaters are not choosing not to show that is because they're afraid that this group, the Guardians of Peace, I guess is what they're calling themselves, are going to come after them and hack into their information and release that. And then that's more information for the celebrity complex to go after, you know. So it's really putting a damper on Hollywood at a time, the Christmas movie season, at a time when they really want to show what they have, as Oscars are coming up and that sort of thing.
And the Guardians of Peace are like a lot of other bad actors these days. They know how to use social media and the traditional media. I mean, they're pulling our strings.
Okay. Well, it looks like the New York Times reporter James Risen will have to answer questions ahead of the trial of a former CIA officer who's accused of leaking classified information. It's not clear exactly what prosecutors want to know, but there is a good chance that they'll ask Risen whether he had an on-the-record source relationship with Jeffrey Sterling. Over the weekend, it sounded like this was kind of a done deal where the chance of him possibly having to do this or potential jail time was kind of off the table. What changed?
I really thought prosecutors were going to just let this one go and try to figure out another way to do it. But I think that their entire case rests on his testimony, or a major part of their case rests on his testimony, which is why they're going to go ahead and pursue this. But I think it really goes down a real slippery slope. And the press, the media is going to have to decide whether or not they're going to be granting confidentiality based on this. And a lot of the reporting that you've seen in Eric Snowden that goes all the way back to the Bush administration, even further back, there's going to be a lot of resistance on the part of the media, as well as those people who think that this kind of information needs to be public. That's going to stifle a lot of that.
And I think a lot of this stuff is shorthand. We were reassured because Eric Holder, the attorney general, says, well, no, we're not going to be prosecuting Risen, not under my watch. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that they can't indirectly ask questions which might put him in jeopardy when he refuses to testify. And even if the prosecutors, who are going to have this huddle with the judge outside the courtroom to see what the line of questioning is that might be acceptable, you've got the defense lawyer sitting there for this guy who's being tried for treason, basically saying, hey, we might want to ask him questions that could expose him to jeopardy, too.
I think any kind of questioning, I mean, putting him on the stand sets a very bad precedent, not only for prosecutors, but also for the media. And that's something that everyone involved needs to look at, not only the prosecutors, but the defense attorneys as well, because now you're going to have them going out, going after reporters as well. So reporters are going to have to be concerned about what their liability is, not just in terms of their sources, but also going up against the state.
Okay. Well, Bill and Camille Cosby have broken their silence, each granting separate interviews this week. Bill Cosby ended up giving an interview to a reporter from the New York Post's Page Six. During their conversation, he said he only expects the black media will uphold the standards of journalism, and that when you do, you have to go in with a neutral mind. It was the comments that his wife made that also have some people talking. She was comparing the allegations against her husband to the UVA sexual assault story in Rolling Stone. What exactly is she trying to say here?
Well, I think what's possibly happening here is that she's trying to muddle the water and basically say that the media didn't do due diligence in covering these allegations that have been brought up against her husband. Similar to what was happening with Rolling Stone and the Washington Post and others, who sort of ferreted out that some of that information that was in that story was not necessarily true. So I think that's one of the things she's trying to do. The other issue with Bill Cosby saying that he thinks he's going to get a better coverage, more fair treatment in the black press. I'm not so sure about that, because yes, there is a lot of conflict going on right now within various aspects of the black community about how do we deal with this Cosby story. And it's a generational thing. Some generation, the older generation may say, wait a minute, hold on, we need to look at this a little bit more. But then you have the younger generation who has looked at what's going on in Virginia, the Ray Rice situation, the Adrian Peterson situation, Ferguson, Eric Garner. You throw all of that together and they're like, wait a minute, we need to really be transparent about all of this and not just look at it from a lens of we keep our information in house.
And NABJ came out and made a statement about this, basically saying one has nothing to do with the other.
That's right. That's right.
You know, I can understand, you know, for the innocent explanation of Camille Cosby actually just saying, you know, I'm trying to retain some shred of dignity here. That's on one end of the spectrum. Mm-hmm. On the other end of the spectrum, you could say she's enabling her husband's behavior, or at least justifying it. Whatever the reason, I think her analogy is false. I mean, first of all, when you look at the UVA story, the accuser was interviewed, but not the accused. Okay. And that's because they didn't try to interview the accused.
Bill Cosby has lots of opportunities,
right? And frankly, the vetting of the accusers has also been gone on with the press as much as they could with these women who've accused Cosby. Third, Cosby's a public figure, and neither the accused nor the accusers in the UVA story until she came forward with this story were public figures. And then if you look at the whether the black media should be more fair, he doesn't want fairness. Look at the interview he gave. He gave it to Page Six, a gossip columnist for the New York Post. He doesn't want fair coverage. He wants fawning coverage, or he wants the kind of coverage where you don't ask tough questions.
And the thing about it is he said very little in that interview. I mean, it pretty much he said a couple of lines. He talked about the black person. And then he said, well, my attorneys don't want me to talk about this. No one wants me to talk about this. I mean, and that's part of the problem in and of itself right there. If you aren't getting your story out, if your attorneys aren't getting your story out, if your handlers aren't getting your story out, then a narrative is going to be created by others. And that is basically what's happening here.
Okay. Well, it was one of those headlines that grabbed you in a second. A New York City high schooler had made $72 million playing the stock market. Impressive, right? You'd click to read how he did it, and I know I did. But it turns out the teen, Muhammad Islam, made up the whole story, he told New York Magazine's Jessica Pressler. This is a doozy for a bunch of reasons.
Well, yeah, first of all, I mean, this were not professional hoaxsters, and there are professional hoaxsters out there.
These were high school kids who wanted to see if they could get someone to
they
buy into their story.
They told a little fib, and then it kept snowballing and snowballing. They go on CNBC, and then they just get scared. They say, I can't do this. We can't maintain the fiction anymore. So that's one of the interesting things. They should have known better, maybe. But for sure, the New York Magazine should have known better. I mean, come on. They wanted to believe this story because it fit in with their, what was it, top 10 or or 12 reasons
right,
that New York
to
is
love
so great.
New York or something. I think
they wanted to believe
to-
it.
I think it goes back to that. They wanted to believe the story because it's such a feel-good thing. And we're in that feel-good time of season, you know, where we got to have these kinds of stories. So I, when I first read it, I was going like, okay, come on. There's so many holes in this story. There is no way that you could actually think that this is actually true.
Well, and I understand that concept that magazines tend to have a much longer lead time in production, but the timing of this falling apart on the heels of the UVA,
well,
the idea of verification, the idea of another huge, highly publicized issue of verification not being done well enough, this was just
and
bad.
The problem for me is that I could see this one story in isolation. Okay, the media wanted to believe it. It was a feel-good story. The kids screwed up. We're all sorry. Move on to the next thing. But the same kind of impulse on the part of the media is what led to the problem with the Rolling Stone story. Mm-hmm. I suspect the reporter and the editors wanted to believe that at a fraternity house there could be this horrible gang rape of this poor student.
Mm-hmm. Because it makes a good story.
The media wanted to believe during the Duke lacrosse case that these white privileged sports figures would rape a working class black woman. They wanted to believe it, so they didn't do the due diligence on the story.
And that it really goes back to that is the old adage of when we were coming up in journalism, where if your mother says she loves you, check it out.
That city news adage goes back decades.
We really need to go back to that because over and over and over again, we sit here every week and we talk about stories that if someone just did a little bit more due diligence, you would find
that we wouldn't have anything to talk about.
That's true. We wouldn't have anything to talk
about.
Well,
it's a hard time to be MSNBC, falling far behind Fox News and CNN in the ratings. Maybe its new initiative will help out a bit. MSNBC launched a new online product this week. It's called The Shift by MSNBC. It's starting off with 14 new original online-only programs on specific topics such as sports, pop culture, politics, other things that may be talkers. What's the goal here in trying to make this project fly?
I think it's to get better content, try things out, see if it works, and then, you know, you go on and put it on the air. Or if not, you trash it.
I'm going to give them half of a hand clap for this because, okay. I mean, I do think that it is good to be doing these online innovative initiatives. And what they're doing on air is not really working lately. But on the other hand, the head of MSNBC was quoted, I think, in one of the articles you posted as saying something similar to, it's kind of like our farm system because none of their big talent are doing these things on the side. Well, if you ask me, doing this kind of online targeted content shouldn't be the farm system. This should be your major play. These should be your big leaguers.
Yeah, they need to really, if they're gonna get back in the race, they're gonna have to ramp up both online as well as on air.
So I want to take some time before we go today to talk about the year that's passed. This is going to be the last time that the three of us are going to be getting together to chat this year. So how about we take a quick look back at the big stories of 2014. Ernest, I want to start with you. What's the story that will stick with you from this year?
Well, I think Two stories that will stick with me. One is definitely Ferguson and what's come out of that and Eric Garner. I think that's going to go on into 2015 and even beyond because we're starting to have that conversation that we've been talking about we need to have for a generation now, which is the conversation of race. And it's been a tumultuous and sometimes violent and nasty conversation, but it's going to happen. And it's being led from a grassroots movement, which is something that needed to happen. It couldn't have happened from where it was trying to begin with the President's Council and all of those things. So I think that's one story. The other one is Ebola. I mean, that was a story that we talked about it for weeks and weeks.
Every time I would say to Ernest, we're going to talk about Ebola, I would kind of put my hand over my head and try to protect myself a little bit because I knew it wasn't going to be his favorite thing to talk about.
I mean, it was a huge story, and I think it was one of the missed marks for the news media because we should have been out front on that one. And I'm talking about not just the United States, I'm talking about worldwide. We should have been out front on that and we weren't. And even today, it's still getting lost because that story is still there and it's still happening and we're really not doing what we need to do in terms of covering that.
So I'm going to stipulate those two and add one more that we could talk about and then tell you what I'm really interested in. So I think violence against women is another big topic. And you look from Ray Rice, the UVA case, the Sasha Menukori case,
yes,
here on
locally.
Campus, George Will saying that, you know, women who've raped on campus have coveted status. There's all kinds of examples of that one. I'm going to pick one that maybe is a little less obvious. It was a big story. It was the Malaysia Airlines Flight 370. And I'll tell you why I picked it as the story of the year. It was a classic story. Doesn't matter what medium you're talking about, you know, how could all these people disappear in a day and age with satellites and the internet and all
100
that stuff?
100 years ago, maybe you could understand
it's a huge story regardless, mm-hmm. but it also showcases both the strengths and the weaknesses of the media all at the same time. So no matter what tools we had at our disposal, we haven't solved this mystery. What we did instead was show some of our worst.
You're absolutely right
worst
about that.
Let's put you in all the rumors and the gossip, and let's put you in the simulator, and let's spend all of our time talking about this story to the absence of any other thing.
I mean,
and
you would have to say that story brought CNN back from the dead. It really did.
And now we haven't heard about it for how long?
It's been, what?
A good five months.
Yeah.
But it just encapsulates everything good and bad about the media in 2014 in one story.
Okay. There's one thing, as we were kind of discussing prior to today's show taping about what we were going to bring to the table. One of the things I thought about that we spent a lot of time this year talking about how our content gets delivered and looking and talking about Aereo and how that was going to be the next big thing, these micro antennae, and then the Supreme Court saying that it was actually an illegal transmission, and then that company now going bankrupt. And the idea of alternative delivery methods, HBO, kind of unlocking HBO Go so that you don't need to have the cable subscription anymore. So I know that's also, in my mind, in addition to Ferguson and the violence against women in Malaysia 370, you can't look back without also thinking about what's to come. And today there was a big story that we're waiting still to see how it's going to play out. And I think 2015 could be the year that we're going to spend a whole lot of time talking about Cuba.
Yeah, the president announcing this morning that we're going to have formal diplomatic relations, open up an embassy to go to Cuba. You know, so now people won't have to figure out other ways to get to Cuba. They can just hop on a plane or hop on a boat and go straight there from Florida. And it puts Florida in play right now in terms of the 2016 election. I mean, it just changes the whole dynamic.
One thing that interests me, there's some stories we can predict, right? We know there's going to be the Bush-Clinton, story again for next year. We know there's going to be more celebrity gossip and more hacking stories and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. Here's one I'm interested to see if it will happen or not. Is there going to be a wholesale attitude change regarding sort of income inequality and how we report on that? Mm. The way there's been a wholesale attitude change about marriage equality or, for that matter, marijuana legalization, is that the next big trend in public attitudes? I don't know. Maybe it will be.
I would hope so, because, I mean, we've talked about it several times here about what's going to be one of those generational stories. And I think income inequality, along with that larger conversation on race in this country, I think that's going to be a continuing story next year.
Okay, well, that music means we are pretty much out of time for today. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about the topics we talked about today. You can check out our links blog for background on that. It's under the programs tab at kbia.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again. Leave us comments, questions, see what we'll be talking about next time, and more. Our thanks to our technical team, Travis McMillan, Austin Federa, Maya Jackson, and to associate producer Hope Kerwin. Pat Akers is running the audio for us today. As I said, we're going to be taking a few weeks off for the holidays. We want to wish you a joyous holiday season and Happy New Year. And we'll be back with you January 7th. Until then, I'm Amy Simons. Thanks for joining us for Views of the News.